Hello, everyone, and welcome to part two of our interview with Mr. Hugh Siegel. So, Mr. Siegel, I'd just like to begin by talking a little bit about your earlier life. You entered politics at such a young age. Where did this drive to have a political career come from?
It's really simple. It was one event in 1962. The Prime Minister of Canada, John Diefenbaker, came to my little private religious school in the riding of Mount Royal just before the 62 general election. And what he spoke about there was not politics and who you should vote for. But what he spoke about was something called the Canadian Bill of Rights, which his government had passed through the Parliament of Canada in 1960. And it was the first clear and precise description of what a non-discriminatory society meant. The rights of people of different languages and backgrounds and genders and ethnicities and languages to be equal parts of society, to be treated fairly by government, not to have prejudice used against them. And it was a very groundbreaking event at the time. And our school was made up of a lot of kids who were the children of immigrants from around the world, many who were Holocaust survivors. And for him to come in and make that speech, and I'll never forget him saying he could have campaigned for Prime Minister under his mother's maiden name, which was Bannerman, which is a sort of an old-time Scottish name. But the family name was Diefenbaker. It was a Dutch-German name. And he was going to hang in there because his view was whether your name was Smith or Jones or Diefenbaker or Balsay or Trombley, there was a place at the Canadian table for you if you were prepared to do your fair share for everybody else around the table. And that was a very, very moving. I was 12 and a half. And I went home for Friday night dinner. Now, understand, my grandfather had been a CCF, which is the New Democratic Party organizer, labor organizer. And my father was a campaign manager for the Liberal Party in the next constituency. And I announced that I was going to support Mr. Diefenbaker and his candidate. I was really impressed with his speech. My father said over my dead body, and when you get that kind of response from your dad, and it doesn't involve sex, drugs, or rock and roll, you're onto something. And my mother said, because she wanted peace at the family table, Huey, just write a note to all the different political leaders and ask them why a young person should join their party. Wait till you get the response. Moms want peace at the family table, so I wrote a note to all of them. And I never met Diefenbaker. My family was of no consequence. My dad was a cab driver. My mother was a cashier in an all-night pharmacy. We were low middle income, poor, working poor kinds of folks. And I get these, what I would call, we call it now photostat, but in those days the term was mimeographed letters, which were sort of like broad distribution letters from three of the leaders, including Mr. Pearson, Mr. Douglas, Mr. Thompson. From Mr. Diefenbaker, I got a personal letter. Now, I'm a kid. This is a whole other question. Why was he spending his time writing personal letters to kids? He should have been running the country.
Yeah.
It was a personal letter and a series of speeches that had been made of foreign policy, defense policy, economic policy. And so this is what a bright young person should think about joining my party. And of course, once that happens, you're all 12 and a half. You begin to take it too seriously. And that's how it started.
And you served as chief of staff to Bill Davis eventually, and I think you were only about 29 or so, correct, when you first started?
Yeah, that's right. I was the youngest. When I joined his staff, it was 1975, so I was 25. I was his legislative assistant. Then I rose to the rank of principal secretary. Then I went to the private sector for a couple of years. Then he brought me back to be an Associate Secretary of Cabinet for Federal-Provincial Relations. And I became the prime negotiator with Mr. Trudeau's government for the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Patriation of the Constitution in 81 and 82, and then the Energy Agreement, which followed thereupon. So I was the youngest deputy minister in that cycle ever appointed. And then when I retired to go into the private sector after my daughter was born, I was the youngest deputy minister to ever retire. So it was a great privilege, and he was a wonderful guy.
You also eventually served as chief of staff to former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney.
Right.
And if you could remember some of the most important policy issues that you dealt with, or even the most memorable, what would they be?
Well, interestingly enough, thinking about your colleague's questions a few moments ago, probably the most interesting event for Mr. Davis on social policy was a decision to bring in the guaranteed annual income supplement for seniors. So back in the mid-70s, most of our senior citizens over 65 were women. The men died younger in those days. And most of them were doing okay, but 35% of those women were living in poverty. When I say living in poverty, they were literally buying dog food and cat food to add some protein to their diet. And that produced a motion in one of our committees to reduce the minister and deputy minister's salary to a dollar because they weren't doing enough. And when the government looked into it, it decided to deal with this issue, and we introduced something called the Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement, automatically topping up people beneath the poverty line. And we took the poverty rate from 35% to 3% in 2 years. A huge impact on people's lives. Seniors began to live longer in Ontario. They lived in better homes. They ate better. And what do you think they did? They were more generous to their grandchildren. They did what most seniors would normally do. So that was in the social side, and then probably working with Mr. Davis on the negotiation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the new Constitution was a very significant opportunity for a young person. It was also a nearly lost thing. It came very close to collapsing. So the fact that Mr. Davis was able to play a role and use people like myself to be helpful was huge. In the Mulroney case, I would say that probably the most interesting challenge was the negotiation of the Charlottetown Accord. So if you remember your history, Mr. Mulroney had negotiated the Meech Lake Accord, which was a historic bringing of Quebec back into the constitutional family and putting a whole bunch of new principles in place. It was rejected by voters in a referendum. And then Quebec said, well, because they had supported Meech Lake, now that they've set that aside, we have to have a vote on independence, unless there's a new proposal from Ottawa. So we were facing, and by the way, when he said that, Premier Bourassa, the Parti Québécois was about 73% of the polls, well ahead. So we had to find a way to bring Quebec back into the family in a commitment that would be shared by other provinces. It was a very intense period of negotiation led by Mr. Mulroney. As his chief of staff, I was engaged on a whole bunch of fronts. And when we reached the Charlottetown Accord, which also got put forward to a referendum, the bottom line was that while Quebecers did not vote for it, a whole bunch of other parts of the country didn't vote for it, so Quebec was no longer isolated. There was a province of the Maritimes, of Alberta, there was other parts of Canada, plus Quebec. So therefore, the consensus of living with what we had and Quebec staying at the table was alive and well. And that, I think, was very important because we took the bullet out of the gun. I misspoke. The Meech Lake Accord never had a referendum. It just failed because Newfoundland and Manitoba refused to take the approving motion through their legislatures. But nevertheless, it produced the same crisis.
Right. And in your political career, you worked extensively on social and constitutional policy, as we just spoke about. But after being appointed to the Senate, you were the chair of the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and the International Trade. Could you talk a bit about those experiences?
Sure. The nice thing about the Senate is that while you are sitting, as I sat as a conservative, others sat as liberals or a few independents, generally speaking, you did not divide along partisan lines. So when I took over as chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, I inherited work that had been done when a liberal had been chair on the effectiveness of our foreign aid and Canadian aid to sub-Saharan Africa. We completed that report, worked on it with some intensity, and produced some very strong recommendations about the reform of CETA, which was finally accepted by the government of the day. I also had the great privilege of working on other proposals which were very, very helpful. I brought in a bill that would say that when members of the Canadian Armed Forces Reserve volunteer for service abroad, their jobs in the federal jurisdiction had to be preserved for at least a year. Because we had young men and women going abroad who were civil servants, they worked in the banking sector and other sectors that are federally regulated. They'd go abroad for 6 months, come back, and the job was gone. Well, how is that going to encourage people to volunteer and be in the reserves? So that got changed. The other piece of legislation I got changed was a piece of legislation that said that all government departments Crown corporations had to report their financial activity on a quarterly basis, just like private sector companies do, to the stock market, so that taxpayers knew how the money was being spent. It's not only a question of why more money might be spent, it's also a question of why less money might be spent. Why would you spend less, for example, on prevention of epidemics in one year than you did in the previous year? We wouldn't know about, under the old system, about any of that until 18 to 24 months after the expenditures had been made. So those were three areas where I tried to work very, very hard. And then on anti-terrorism, we worked very hard to propose that Canada fall in line with all of our major NATO partners and have a statutory legislative oversight of our national security and intelligence vehicles. And that bill, I think it was called S-220, was basically adopted by the present Trudeau government. And it's the basis of legislation now going forward to set up an independent legislative oversight of our national security premises.
It's perfect that you alluded to that, because terrorism today is a very pressing issue, especially in European countries. In your opinion, with all the expertise that you've had, what would be your advice to the current government on the best way to combat terrorism?
There are two varieties. There is the externally driven, encouraged, armed, and financed. And then there is what happens when you get local individuals who become radicalized to the point of considering violence. And the strategies on both have to be different and very, very specialized. With respect to the former, it's really important that our international networks, our linkages, our engagement at borders is robust and constructive. So the legislation brought in by the Harper government to say, if you go abroad to work for ISIS or to work for a terrorist organization, that in and of itself is a crime, independent of whatever else you might do when you're there. Which means that you can then be arrested via Interpol as you travel, and you can be apprehended when you come back to Canada. So it's very important, because those are the folks who, if you think about it, they've gone overseas, they've fought with ISIS for a while, or with other terrorist groups. They are then trained, they have skill sets, then they come back to Canada. What happens then? How do you deal with it? We also have to, and so that's a robust intelligence system that moves quickly and that apprehends information in a way that allows you to be proactive and prophylactic in keeping bad things from happening. Part of what we also recommended was that CSIS, which is the key international and domestic intelligence agency for Canada, have the ability to act within the law to prevent bad things from happening. So when we had in Toronto something called the Toronto 18, that number was actually much higher. It was actually a number in the 20s. But what happened, and this is very much to the credit of Toronto Police, when they had information that indicated that some young people were involved in discussions online and elsewhere which could lead to real problems, they would go, so think about this, there's a woman who's a pharmacist, she has a late teenage son, who doesn't know what he does online, who does, and she's visited by two uniformed female police officers at the pharmacy where she works, and says, I wonder if you can help us, we have some concerns about your son, could you give us advice? Nobody's being arrested. Nobody's having their privacy invaded. Well, of course, the minute the mother heard, I mean, she came down on her son like a ton of bricks. She kept him out of serious trouble. So there are ways that police and others can work to prevent bad things from happening before they happen that don't involve violating the law or anybody's charter rights. And I think we have to do more of that. We have to do that not only in communities that may share some measure of ethnicity or religion with some of the potential bad actors, but in a broad sense, aimed at that age group of people who will act out, will consider doing things that are unconstructive. And look, one of the worst terrorist events took place in Kansas, in Oklahoma City. It didn't involve anybody from the Islamic world. It wasn't about that. It was about strong, right-wing American terrorists who were nutso. So we have to take away the ethnic self, because sometimes if you think the ethnic thing is proscriptive, then you're looking always in the wrong place. You have to have a much broader view of society, and that involves networks in our schools, it involves after-school activity, it involves robust sports and engagement. So it has to be a multifaceted process, and it can't just be done by the government of Canada. You've got to have a community-wide commitment, because if you think about it, terrorism is the ultimate delinquency. It's the ultimate truancy. It's the ultimate way of getting back at your parents, getting back at your neighborhood, getting back at people who you don't think are treating you fairly. We have to make sure that people of all backgrounds know that there are better ways to deal with that anger than to create huge pain and suffering for others and ruin your own life forever.